Lecture 80, Religion in 20th Century America.
By the early 20th century, America was the most ethnically and religiously diverse nation in the world. And in the 20th century, it showed a continuing capacity to assimilate new ethnic types and new religions from all over the world. The First Amendment assured separation of church and state. It also assured everybody's freedom of religion, and this combination enabled the many denominations and faiths to coexist. America's long tradition of religious revivals, already two centuries old, found its latest embodiment in Billy Graham, the great preaching sensation of the late 40s and early 50s. Religious tensions included a long-running anti-Catholicism among Protestants and a low-level anti-Semitism until the mid-1940s. Revelations about the Holocaust made anti-Semitism disgraceful. The election of President Kennedy and the Second Vatican Council from 1962 to 65 had the same effect on anti-Catholicism, which diminished quickly. America remained a far more religious society than the other Western industrial democracies, another example of its exceptionalism. And it appeared to deny the validity of secularization theory, according to which, as societies become more modern, they become more secular. The late 20th century witnessed an exotic array of new sects and cults, from the ex-hippie Jesus freaks to the followers of Jim Jones, the People's Temple, who committed mass suicide in the Guyana jungle in 1978. Religious groups also played an important role in the great moral and political debates of the era over civil rights, feminism, the abortion controversy, homosexuality, and nuclear weapons. Well, after the First World War, the nation came to terms with its multi-religious character, and I'd like to recap a couple of issues I mentioned briefly previously. Protestants were still numerically dominant among all the American people, but the Protestant churches, already divided into numerous denominations, further split between liberal and evangelical groups. Some of the issues over which they divided were historical critical method, how you should think about scripture, whether you should think about it as a series of historical documents which had developed over time in response to pressing historical questions, or whether you should think about it as God's revealed word. And over the question of evolution, ever since the 1850s, Darwin had challenged the idea that the Genesis account of creation was historically reliable. Evangelicals and fundamentalists said that the Bible trumped all other sources of information, whereas the liberal Protestants took the view, no, we've got to adapt our faith to the insights brought to us by the very best of contemporary intellectual life, even if it carries us off in unexpected directions. Fundamentalism was itself a 20th century phenomenon, and the fundamentalists are named after a group of pamphlets whose wide publication and distribution was subsidized by a pair of entrepreneurs, Milton and Lyman Stewart, who said in the teens of the 20th century, these are the basic questions on which we mustn't compromise. The inerrancy of scripture, the reality of miracles, the reality of the virgin birth, the reality of Jesus's physical resurrection. Well, this fracture in American Protestantism was exposed by the Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925. Tennessee passed a law outlawing the teaching of evolution. John Scopes, the high school science teacher in Dayton, Tennessee, taught evolution anyway, was prosecuted and was convicted. I mean, he had in fact broken the Tennessee law. And it was a great encounter, a publicity encounter between the two sides of American Protestantism. Although Tennessee won the conviction, certainly in the public relations battle, the fundamentalists lost. They were widely scorned by the national press. And after 1925, the evangelical and Protestant groups tended to withdraw from active engagement in political life. It wasn't until the last two decades of the 20th century that they re-emerged as a significant political force. Meanwhile, the liberal Protestants continued to try to adapt to the most recent intellectual trends. The most influential liberal Protestant theologian of the 20th century was Reinhold Niebuhr. In the early 1930s, he published a book called Moral Man and Immoral Society. It's a book of Christian ethics in which he points out the way in which, although individuals can strive for moral perfection, it's impossible and unrealistic to ask a society to do so, moral man and immoral society. And it had profound implications for Christian thinking about politics. In other words, we can't think about politics as a perfectionist arena. It's simply governments and states simply aren't like that. He himself, Niebuhr himself, had earlier been a Christian pacifist. But in the 1930s, particularly in light of the rise of Hitler in Germany, he began to advocate the consistency within Christianity of going to war against a great tyrant. And after the war, he was also a very important contributor to developing the Cold War orthodoxy about the menace of communism and the need to stand up to it, if necessary, with drastic remedies. In 1952, he wrote the book The Irony of American History, which, again, I've mentioned earlier in the course, in which he says, ironically, we're a civilization which is now defending itself with a weapon so horrifying that were we to use it, we'd have to disavow all claims to be a civilization. But that doesn't mean, therefore, that we've got to get rid of it. This is the agonizing dilemma which our principles and values and our commitment to nuclear weapons have got us into. Well, about a third of the American population were Roman Catholics. And the Catholic Church assimilated very, very diverse peoples from all different areas of Europe and turned them into Americans by refusing to let itself become ethnically subdivided by the many categories. One of the ways in which the Catholics asserted their permanent place in American life was through great architectural monuments, like St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, which was built in the later decades of the 19th century. Sometimes, in their striving for making a really big mark on the landscape, they perhaps got more size than aesthetic quality. Think, if you've seen it, the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception at Catholic University of America. It's a monstrous object, but much ridiculed by architectural critics because its size seems to have run away with it. But sometimes the Catholic builders, the Catholic architects, could be very subtle. The historian Edward Kantowitz has given us a beautiful example of that in describing the building policies of Cardinal Mundelin of Illinois, the man who was the head of the Chicago Catholic Archdiocese from 1915 right through the New Deal era. When he built a new seminary, this is in a town which is now named after him, in Mundelin, Illinois, in suburban Chicago, he built St. Mary of the Lake Seminary, and he modeled the buildings on the outside on the buildings that Thomas Jefferson had created in building the University of Virginia. So as you look at it from the outside, which if you're a Protestant is the only part you'll ever see, it's quintessentially American architecture. But inside, it's a copy of the Barberini Palace in Rome, part of the Vatican complex. So of course, the visiting apostolic delegate from Rome who's come across to make sure that orthodoxy is being observed in America sees this side of the building. In the same way, he built his own bishop's palace as a model of Mount Vernon, George Washington's house. So Cardinal Mundelin himself understood the symbolic importance of making the buildings fit and look right in the American landscape. And in fact, the American hierarchy, the Catholic hierarchy, always walked a tightrope between reassuring the Americans that they really were 100% Americans and reassuring the Vatican, which was always rather suspicious of America, that they weren't compromising their religious orthodoxy in any way. I mentioned in the earlier religious lecture that they'd pursued the policy of building their own school system, which also made them seem rather standoffish. They did want to be different. They did want to be different, but not too different. And that was the balancing act they had to fulfill. A Catholic organization, the Legion of Decency, played an important role in Hollywood in the middle of the 20th century. In the 1920s and 30s, as Hollywood films were becoming a massive industry in America, the Catholic priests particularly were angered by the depiction of sex, which they thought was too explicit, by fictional characters using drugs, and also by a series of gangster films whose message was, crime does pay. And the Catholic Church threatened that they would boycott Hollywood if there wasn't some moral reformation within the plots and depictions shown by the films. Now, in those days, Catholic people tended to be very obedient to their priests. And if the parish priest said, you must not go and see this film, most of them wouldn't go. Now, Hollywood, facing the possibility that it might lose a third of its audience for some of its products, and facing the hazard that the government itself might decide to intervene to start monitoring films, set up an organization called the Hayes Office, to which all new films, before they were released, were sent for censorship, in effect. And the Hayes office, it was a self-policing mechanism, but they'd certainly consult regularly with the Legion of Decency, this Catholic organization, to make sure that the films presented all issues, and particularly Catholic-related issues, in a way which the church hierarchy found acceptable. That's really why, if you see any film made between the early 1930s and about 1960, the depiction of the Catholic Church is highly favourable. Think about films like Going My Way or The Bells of St. Mary's. The priests are the heroes. Perhaps one of the greatest in this tradition is I Confess. This is a Hitchcock film made in the early 50s. And it's a wonderful dramatic tale because it's about the fact that a murderer confesses the murder to the priest in the knowledge that he's protected by the seal of the confessional. Now that he's confessed, the priest cannot tell the police the identity of the murderer, even though he knows it. And the dramatic tension is greatly heightened by the fact that the priest, played by Montgomery Clift, is himself the next presumptive victim. But he's an incorruptible priest, and in the end, I'm not giving anything away by telling you that it ends happily with his life being saved and the villains being brought to justice. But the film is arranged around the fact that the Catholic priest to whom confession has been made cannot say what he was told. Jews were about 3% of the American population, a much smaller percentage, but nevertheless an influential one. And within the Jewish population, a debate continued about whether they should or should not assimilate to mainstream American life. Reform Jews, in the tradition of Isaac Mayer Wise, emphasized the ethical side of their tradition rather than the ritual side, and they were the most assimilationist. On the other side, the Orthodox Jews, most of them descended from Eastern European immigrants between 1880 and 1920. Tried to resist assimilation. They carried on maintaining the food rituals, the kosher. They had a very, very strong principle of restricting marriage of their members within the community. But they too went through intense pressures to assimilate in the face of new American circumstances. Earlier in the course, talking about immigration, I read to you from Abraham Kahan's novel, The Rise of David Levinsky. Another beautiful novel about Jewish assimilation is Bread Givers by Anzia Yezierska, published in 1925. And she talks about, it's a semi-autobiographical novel in which Yezierska talks about stresses within an immigrant Jewish family. The father is a Talmudic scholar who regards scholarship as much more important than working, with the result that his family, now living in the east side of New York, is desperately poor. He's got four daughters, and for the first three of them, he makes ruinously unsuitable choices of men they should marry. But because they're so docile and deferential to him, they do marry those men, and it all turns out horribly badly. The youngest daughter, through whose eyes we see the story unfolding, refuses to do it and makes a break from her family, even though the emotional stress of doing so is very great. It's part of a huge literature of the stresses which accompany ethnic and religious assimilation. The middle course between Orthodoxy and Reform was conservative Judaism, itself an American invention. And it became a very popular compromise position as the American Jewish population spread out into the suburbs, particularly after the Second World War, as American towns started to spread and as more people could afford to get away from the ethnic particular areas in which often their families had first lived. So for the post-ghetto generation of American Jews, very often in a new suburban community would create a conservative synagogue, keeping the rules but without being so emphatically separationist. However, right up to the present, there is the most separatist group of American Jews are the Hasidic, whose populations in Brooklyn remain a very, very distinctive dress, the distinctive hair locks for the men and wigs for the women, and the black clothes, which make them instantly identifiable in New York life. And their way of life is beautifully encapsulated in the novels of Chaim Potok, particularly The Chosen and My Name is Asher Lev, about the problems of intellectually precocious young Hasidic men. Mutual religious tolerance increased in the second half of the 20th century. The Holocaust and the creation of Israel contributed to the end of American anti-Semitism. It had already been mild by European standards, and after the full news of the Holocaust had become known by 1950, it became an impermissible breach of national standards. In an influential book written in 1955 called Protestant Catholic Jew, the sociologist Will Herberg said, "When we're looking at American religion, very often what we're really tracing isn't so much the beliefs of groups of people so much as their ethnic identity. And he said, America doesn't really have a melting pot. It has three of them. The triple melting pot is one of his phrases. He says, look what happens in immigrant populations. The first generation coming in tend to stick very closely to their own. But the second generation does an interesting thing. You'll find that Jews who came from the Austro-Hungarian Empire will intermarry with Jews who came from Germany. And Catholics who came from Poland will intermarry with Catholics who came from Ireland or from Italy. In other words, the marriage will cross the ethnic lines, but it won't cross the religious boundary. So what we've got is a Protestant melting pot, a Catholic one, and a Jewish one. Were he to revisit the situation today, he'd find that that also was breaking down because marriage across religious lines became far, far more commonplace in the 1960s and 70s. And Herberg was one of the people who popularized the idea of the Judeo-Christian tradition, the idea that they've got more in common than they have separating them. See, the Judeo-Christian tradition is itself an American idea, and it implies a continuity in these biblical religions rather than a sharp separation between them. Well, Kennedy's electoral success in 1960 and the Second Vatican Council, which began to transform the Catholic world in between 62 and 65, contributed to the end of American anti-Catholicism, which until then had also had a very vigorous and intense life. Paul Blanchard was the last of the highbrow anti-Catholics who could make a serious argument to the effect that Catholics couldn't be good Americans because their primary loyalty was to an Italian monarch, the Pope. It was true, incidentally, that the Catholic bishops could be very high-handed. Cardinal Archbishop Spellman of New York was a great autocrat who tried to run the Archdiocese of New York in the 50s and 60s almost as his personal fiefdom, and he certainly sometimes caused great antagonism among the other religious groups because of it. Even so, the kinds of anti-Catholic protests which preceded the election of President Kennedy weren't matched once he'd come into office, partly because there was no sign at all of actual Catholic influence over Kennedy's policies. Now, during the Kennedy administration in 1962 and 63, the Supreme Court made a series of decisions which sharpened the separation between church and state. In an important 1962 case, for example, the Supreme Court said that the schoolchildren of New York must not start the day by reciting a prayer. It was an interdenominational prayer, and ministers, priests, and rabbis had all approved it. But nevertheless, the court said there must be no prayers at all because it's a violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. The next year, they found in subsequent decisions that neither must there be any Bible reading in schools. In making these two decisions, the court was violating a very, very long tradition of the inclusion of Protestant worship, more or less diluted, inside the American public schools. And it enraged many church leaders. A movement to impeach the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren, was set in motion. It was also he, of course, who presided over the controversial Brown case, which ended school segregation. Well, constitutional amendments to restore God to the classroom never succeeded, but they were always percolating through Congress in the 1960s. Meanwhile, and ever since, more and more Americans, particularly in the Protestant evangelical denominations, decided to take their children out of the public schools altogether and instead build evangelical private academies where their children could be educated, in which their secular education and their faith were reinforced together, rather than being rigorously separated. The social movements of the 1960s gave rise to new religions and new versions of old ones. One of the most interesting is the Jesus movement, or sometimes called the Jesus freaks. One of the popular impulses of the 1960s was the hippie movement, which constituted a rejection of the values of mainstream society. The hippies said, we're not going to get into the rat race. We're not going to be constantly thinking about making money and getting ahead. Instead, we're going to appreciate the simple pleasures of life. We're going to live harmoniously together. We're going to get rid of the tyrannical rules and regulations which govern our parents. We're in favor of peace, not war, love, music, good feeling, and so on. And like every group in American religious history, the first thing they said was, Jesus was just like us. After all, he was a man with long hair who wore comfortable, loose-fitting clothing, wandered about, told great stories, was a man of essential goodness, had a beautiful understanding of people, and preached a message of peace. And that's what we're like as well. Well, various places, notably the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco, became hippie ghettos, hippie environments. But there was a disillusioning and a sinister underside to what was called the Summer of Love, the summer of 1967 in Haight-Ashbury. And a Christian evangelical called Ted Wise set up a Christian, an evangelical shelter in the Haight-Ashbury district to provide a place for disillusioned young hippies to go, particularly people who had been caught up in the drug culture, which was synonymous with hippie life. Ted Wise's place was called the Living Room. He helped kids get off drugs and tried to prevent them from living a very promiscuous sex life, and instead to give them a sense of community and some rules to live by without turning against what seemed to him also like the good side of the hippie philosophy. Very quickly, this was an insight which was embodied in a musical show, Jesus Christ Superstar, by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. Down in Los Angeles, Arthur Blessed was doing something very similar. He had a storefront church on Sunset Strip, right down amidst all the strip clubs and the sex joints. And after preaching to mainly teenagers, who runaways, many of them, he'd have what he called toilet services, where he encouraged the kids to flush all their drugs away down the toilet and to swear that they'd turn their lives to Jesus and live a purified Christian life. And when they'd got rid of their drugs, he'd then give them a Bible printed on psychedelic paper. And recruited some ingenious helpers to this mission. Here's a little quote from his book, written in 1970, about his mission. Quote, "The first time I met Linda, she was stoned out of her head with acid. She'd ridden with the San Antonio and Houston motorcycle gang, and then with the Hell's Angels. Now working on our staff full time, Linda is beautiful in her dedication to Christ. Her witness is really something else. When guys on bikes come over and ask her to split with them, she hops right on the chopper and takes off. When they stop, she lays the word of the Lord on them. Her witnessing almost freaks them out." So she's converting them by talking with them in an idiom they're familiar with. Later on, when rival businessmen found that it gave punters a bad conscience to have this church there in the middle of the sex clubs, so they tried to get him evicted from his place of work. But Blessed retaliated by having himself chained to a giant cross out in the street and going on a hunger strike until he was able to get a new lease for his church. And he said, "The chain felt wonderful, each link binding me to Christ." Well, another new movement, also from the 1960s and 70s, was the People's Temple. And this was the creation of Jim Jones. Originally an Indianapolis minister, an evangelical minister, he created a completely colorblind church, bringing black and white people, mainly poor, they're not all poor, and they became his personal followers, in effect. He was a highly charismatic preacher. In the early 60s, the time of the Cuba Missile Crisis, Jim Jones became convinced that a nuclear war was going to take place. And after reading about the effects of nuclear weapons, he said, "We've got to get our people away into a sanctuary that's not near to a city. Otherwise, they're going to be vaporized in the great atomic explosion." So the whole community moved from Indianapolis to Ukiah in the California Redwood Forests. Jim Jones gradually developed a messiah complex. He came to believe that he was himself divine, that he could cure cancer by his in his healing services, and he'd have ranting four-hour sermons where nobody was allowed to leave or to move or even to speak. But at the same time, he too was politically popular, particularly in San Francisco, where he started recruiting new members, because he seemed to be very effective at getting people off drugs. On the other hand, some families whose children had joined Jim Jones, joined the People's Temple, became convinced that he was a brainwasher, that he'd mentally seduce people, then take all their property away, and that they'd, in effect, that they'd lost their right minds. In response to some legal challenges about brainwashing, Jones then moved the whole community to Guyana in the jungles of northern South America. A congressman called Leo Ryan went down to see whether some members of the group were being held against their will and was convinced that some of them were. But as he tried to leave the Jonestown, as it was called, the compound where the sect lived, he was ambushed and assassinated. After that, Jones, realizing that the whole group now faced desperate reprisals, committed mass suicide. Nearly 1,000 of them drank Kool-Aid laced with cyanide in a very, very orderly activity, which appears to have been rehearsed. So it's one of the most extraordinary moments and traumatic moments in American religious history. After that, the deprogramming movement became important. This is deprogrammers were people who said, we've got to get people out of these religious cult movements and reorient their way of thinking away from the cult behaviour that they started to follow. It itself had a slightly culty flavour. But what it meant was that after Jonestown, any new religious movement was always labouring under the shadow that it too might be a brainwasher and that it might be very, very self-destructive. That's why new groups like the Moonies and the Rajneeshis were unpopular. Also in the 1970s, lots of women began to question their traditional religious roles. Liberal churches began to say, until now we've only ordained men to the ministry, but really why shouldn't women be ministers too? Some churches quickly made this change. The Episcopal Church ordained women after 1976, for example. The Reformed Jews started to ordain women as rabbis starting in 1972. Other churches refused, again, notably the Catholic Church, because they said, although it's true that men and women are equal, that doesn't mean that they're interchangeable. Jesus was a man, and the 12 people he chose as his disciples were also men. And it isn't a coincidence. It's something we've got to reckon with in taking seriously these differences. So a rumbling source of discontent and controversy in the Catholic Church has been whether or not, in fact, women should be ordained. Meanwhile, feminist theologians were reinterpreting familiar Bible stories. Bernadette Bruton, for example, is one, and she says, what happens in the creation story? Well, God makes the most important things after he's made the less important. That's why he made the earth, then he made the lesser creatures, then he made the higher creatures, then the man, and then the woman. The woman's the triumph of God's creation. And she says, and look what happens in Jesus' stories. The disciples always miss the point, and it's the women, people like Mary and Martha or Mary Magdalene, who always get the point. The Bible's absolutely full of stories demonstrating the superiority of women, a clever way of reinterpreting the traditional Bible stories. Americans who were completely disenchanted by the Judeo-Christian tradition during the upheavals of the 60s and 70s turned to Asian spiritual alternatives. The Beatles took up transcendental meditation after a visit to the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and many Americans followed suit. Zen Buddhism attracted an influential handful of Americans who hoped to adapt it to their lives in the world rather than becoming monks. But of course, if you're a Zen Buddhist in America, it means something very different than if you're a Zen Buddhist in Japan or Tibet, because there it's men only, and it's also an intrinsic part of the tradition. Whereas here in America, it's exotic, and it's being practiced by men and women equally. Nevertheless, Zen Buddhism attracted a handful of enthusiasts, particularly because of its pacifist teachings and its rejection of the striving way of the Western world. Shows up in literature too, in books like Jack Kerouac's The Dharma Bums and Robert Persig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which was a great bestseller of the early 70s. New immigrant generations further diversified America's religious landscape. The Immigration Reform Law of 1965 had abolished national origins distinctions, which enabled people from all over the world to enter America. That meant that the American Islamic population began to climb quite rapidly, partly from African Americans who belonged to the Nation of Islam, the group which Malcolm X had made famous, and leadership first in the hands of Elijah Muhammad and later passing to Louis Farrakhan, were brought in a steady stream of African American recruits. At the same time, immigrants from India and Pakistan and Iran, after the revolution particularly, and Yemen and other Middle Eastern nations brought in Sunni Islam, Sunni Muslims, whose daily practice of prayer and the ritual ablutions which have to precede prayer raise new questions about how you can accommodate the free exercise of religion in places like schools and the workplace, where there's been no prior tradition of activities of that kind. Political tensions after 1980 often subjected American Muslims to discrimination and sometimes even to attack. During the Iranian Revolution, this was true. Then particularly during the Gulf War of the early 90s, and perhaps most severe of all, after the attack on the World Trade Center on the 11th of September 2001. American Hindus entered America in large numbers and found that their way of life was changing even when they tried to prevent it from changing. Like every earlier immigrant and religious group, they found it was very difficult on the one hand to give their children the blessings of American society and on the other hand prevent them from becoming compromising the faith. Here's the sociologist Prima Kurien describing the meetings in Southern California of a Hindu group. They're prosperous South Indians from the state of Kerala. And she witnesses them holding religious meetings called satsangs and balavihars. She says these meetings are part worship, where devotional songs are sung, and they're also partly study of the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu scriptures. But there are also lessons in Tamil, the language of South India, so that the children, while they learn English, won't forget their parents' language and its religion. But as Kurien, the sociologist, says, quote, in this process of institutionalization, Hinduism is being reinvented. Both satsangs and balavihars are forms of religious practice that do not typically exist in India. In fact, group religious activity does not exist in traditional Hinduism. So in other words, even when you're attempting to find a way to pass it on to the children unchanged, you're being forced to change it. Each prior religious immigrant group had found the same thing, and it's continuing right up to the present with Hindus and Muslims. Happening also with Catholics from the Hispanic countries. Since 65, there's been a massive immigration into America from Central and South America. And you can see a wonderful depiction of this kind of new tension in Richard Rodriguez's book, Hunger of Memory. It's the autobiography of a young Mexican immigrant to Sacramento, California, and the simultaneous familiarity of the Catholic Church with the strangeness of Catholicism as it's experienced being celebrated in English rather than in Spanish. Anyway, it remains true that America is unusual for its religious vitality and for its religious diversity, much more so than the other Western industrial nations. By the mid-1970s, moreover, evangelicals and fundamentalist Protestants, who'd been very much in the political background throughout the mid-decades of the century, began returning to it. So dismayed were they by the moral revolutions which had taken place in the 1960s. And we'll see their work, beginning with the election of President Carter and then the creation of the Moral Majority, in the lecture which follows.